everybody. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program Podcast, Finding You. Tonight's guest is Alex White. Alex is one of our intensive therapists and also one of our intensive coaches. And I have had the pleasure of working with him professionally. And I really learned a lot from him during our interview. So, Alex, it's great to have you here on the podcast as a guest. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I like to start off with kind of your journey, your route through counseling, how you got to Evoke into the intensive program. Tell us a little bit about your story and your background leading up to where we are today.
Yeah, I I'm the child of two psychologists, and so in some ways was bred into this field in different ways, though they were pretty gracious about not pushing too much on me or directing me into it. But I think it did inform the way that I was raised and sort of the way that, you know, my siblings and I learned to interact with the world. And so for a while I avoided it, you know, as kind of a kid growing up and just said, you know, who would want to listen to people's problems for a living? Right. And they've been very gracious about not telling me I told you so. But you know, as I finished up with college, at my undergrad, I started work at a therapeutic group home. That was really the first. I had experiences in the past of, you know, kind of working with groups and different kinds of sort of experiential settings and that kind of thing, but never therapeutic until that point. And that really kind of opened my eyes. It was a small facility in Wyoming. So kids coming in with is all court ordered. So really different just background and demographic from the folks I'd worked with, and a lot of, you know, chaos and attachment trauma and that kind of thing in their lives. And as much as it was hard and kind of overwhelming and sort of threw me for a loop at first, that I kind of never really could see myself doing anything else after that. The meaning and fulfillment that I got out of that kind of work was really powerful for me. So spent several years working there as well as other facilities within that organization, and eventually got to a point where I just couldn't accomplish as much as I wanted to without going back to grad school. You know, I was starting to understand more of the underlying processes that were influencing these kids and how they were showing up for me or showing up in the setting. And I didn't have enough experience or enough training to address those underlying issues, right? We could sort of address them on the face of it and learn well how to show up and hold a safe space and be a container and hold boundaries and all that. But some of the underlying concerns were deeper. And it was a conversation with my mom that really, I think, helped stick it for me. I was driving home after a long shift one night, and I was just so frustrated with this one kiddo who had found this way of her way of sort of making herself feel okay was to make others, you know, particularly others in the group home, so other residents feel not okay. And so she found ways to kind of pick at their vulnerabilities and that kind of thing. And it was just, it made for really demanding shifts as a direct care staff member. And I was sort of venting to my mom about it, again, you know, clinical psychologist as a background. And she said to me, you know, she kind of paused and listened and then sort of put it in perspective for me in a way that still sort of gives me goosebumps, when she said, imagine what had to happen to her in her world, in her life, in her family, such that that's the only way that she can figure out how to be okay in the world. And that kind of shut me up. I was like, well, it doesn't feel like, you know, I had been looking at it on the face of it And, you know, had been in this job for quite a while, but that, you know, that process, that reframe of it really stuck with me. And I think still in a lot of ways informs how I show up with clients and that kind of thing. So have, you know, went back to grad school and had worked in various residential private practice settings, and oftentimes have done, you know, done quite a bit that it's involved more experiential work. So whether that's more, you know, outbased working in private practice and running activities with a family or bringing them to the climbing gym or that kind of thing, or, you know, group-based work that is more sort of immersive in nature, and really have been drawn to that kind of, you know, full and holistic experience. I think that's, in some ways, that's sort of where I have found my healing and growth. And so it feels most meaningful for me to bring that to the settings that I'm working in. And so moved to Utah a couple of years ago, after spending 2 years in postgrad internship in Florida, and have been mostly working at the University of Utah Counseling Center as a therapist there and doing some teaching, but really have found that I do really enjoy that work too. It's fun to be a part of, you know, a lot of times the first experience of people having counseling, right, of, you know, coming to it, growing up in small town Utah and making some of the first like autonomous decisions they have for themselves in the world. So I really do love that work, but found that I kind of miss the direct experience and kind of that immersive nature that comes from working in a, you know, more of a residential and therapeutic setting. And so had familiarity with various outdoor behavioral healthcare programs and just programs around Utah, and saw an opportunity come up for the intensives program. And it, you know, I kind of like lit up, because that was sort of felt like what I had been missing in my own clinical work up to this point, is that more immersive experience. And since then, I guess it was early spring last year that you and I ran our first, and have since then run several Finding Yous, and you know, each one has been really different. I've learned a lot, not only as a therapist, but I think as a human, and have really loved the, you know, and just reinforced for me the power of group experience and of holding space and you know, working with a group who is earnestly engaged in wanting to do their own work to grow and be better. You know, it's lots of folks who come in having been introduced to the therapeutic world by virtue of other people in their lives. I think, like, oftentimes, you know, I've seen, you know, partners have kind of referred them, or they might have kids in treatment. And I really respect that willingness to recognize in some ways that these are the issues that are, you know, that might be coming up in a family are everybody's responsibility, and that, you know, that it is powerful to be able to see how people take that head on and can really, you know, engage in some deep and heavy work and unearth things that have been earthed, right, for quite a while. And so I've really just loved that as you know, a shift beyond the 50-minute hour and working with people over Zoom for the last year and a half. And so I'm really grateful for, I'm just coming off one this past weekend, and I'm just sort of continue to be sort of beaming with gratitude and excitement for what's to
come. So cool that you had not just supervision with your mom, but such a simple and profound moment of her inviting a shift. I think that's a really cool part of your story, part of your history. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't grow up with parents who were therapists. I grew up in therapy because I was the problem, right? My children, of course, have grown up with parents who are therapists. What's been the biggest lesson that you've learned from being exposed to the thinking? And I think I know what you're talking about, like the way people talk and describe things, the way people are, because of their training, like your parents and your family, your siblings. What's been the biggest shift or lesson or adjustment from moving from that experience to actually having to sit as an intensive facilitator or sitting across from somebody in that 50-minute hour? What's been the biggest adjustment or lesson in that transition?
I think for me, it's the understanding the intentionality behind how I'm showing up and why I'm showing up, why I'm saying the words I'm saying or not saying the words that I'm saying. I think growing up, we were presented with a setting where, you know, oftentimes there, you know, if something was coming up that we would be, you know, we would have the question follow up of, you know, of tell me more about that, or, you know, what does it feel like, or that kind of thing, which sometimes we'd roll our eyes at. And so I sort of understood innately to some degree how to show up with, you know, sort of some amount of curiosity and openness, and, you know, and even having, you know, two parents who had a background in this, like, I still have my own stuff that shows up. I still have, you know, we all dent our kids, right? Like, even as much as background and experience as they have, I've still got my, you know, my struggles and strategies that I developed. And so I think in some ways, like, understanding the intentionality behind how we show up, but also recognizing that those strategies, like, for me, it was, you know, attending to the environment around me and recognizing and, you know, trying to take care of the people in my life when, you know, when things are really strained at times, when they had my brother and sister are twins. So all of a sudden we went from a family of three to a family of five, and that, you know, put a lot of strain on the family system. And my way of dealing with that was to sort of not put too much strain or burden on anybody and try and take care of what I could. And I think that that's something that, you know, I mean, I think in a lot of ways leads people to a helping field, and, you know, and is also my responsibility to recognize that I'm, you know, there is a tendency for me to want to, or has been anyway, a tendency to, or an impulse to rescue or to try and help people feel better. And I think what I realize, sort of tying all of the pieces together of how I was met as a kid, sort of the strategies that I developed and how those have shown up in different relationships. And as I've done more of my own work, recognizing that, you know, and even how it was with kids, like, it's not about trying to talk them out of their feelings. It's not about, about helping them to feel okay, but more about just helping people to feel heard and met and validated and understand that, like, whatever they're feeling, whether it's painful or overwhelming or sad or angering, that it makes sense and that is an okay way to show up. And I think that's what I think is one of the most powerful experiences, at least that I can reflect on in the intensives I've been a part of, is, you know, I mean, there's great work done and there's, you know, interesting pieces of psychoeducation, but the way in which a group of people can hold space for each other without, you know, invalidating, without trying to talk people out of their experiences or taking away, is something that so many people didn't receive as kids. And that is, you know, continues to be something that is just inspiring to me, is how that can, you know, with the right sort of container and framework and with a self-selecting group who's really willing to, you know, engage in that harder work, how much it means to just, hold space.
That's beautiful. I want to ask you about your approach, about who you work with, you know, who you work with well, maybe even who you struggle with, if you're willing to share that. So tell us about neuroaffective relational model and kind of how that informs your approach to working with the clients that you work with in therapy.
It's a mouthful, and so we call it NARM for short. And it's something that, you know, I was kind of amazed in a lot of ways as soon as I showed up to my first intensive and heard some of the, you know, some of the psychoeducation pieces and even just the underlying principles of sort of how we as therapists seek to show up and facilitate our programs, how much alignment there was between these two approaches. And really, I think NARM is rooted in this idea that essentially we are all products of complex trauma, that whether you call it anxiety or depression or OCD or, you know, any number of labels or categories that we put on it, that all of those things that show up now in day-to-day life were strategies, and were strategies that worked well when we were kids. They were things that we needed to do in situations where our environment wasn't able to meet our needs. And that is sort of, I mean, it informs my approach in working with people no matter what I do at this point. And I think the one of the most, I think, significant principles associated with NARM is that we detach from the outcome, right? Like, the intent is to create a space in which processing can occur and connection can occur. It's not non-directive exactly. So there's intentionality behind the questions that we're asking, but there are, but it's, you know, a lot of focus on compassionate inquiry rather than, you know, teaching the skill or, you know, putting together homework assignments or that kind of thing, because there's this idea that, you know, it's not that like the strategies that you, it's not the idea that you don't have more information, right? Anybody has access to Google and you could find a million different ways to address anxiety or depression or that kind of thing. It's more wondering why the strategies that you have or that you have had in the past aren't working, right? Like, why can't you self-regulate? Why can't you, you know, get out of bed? What's going on such that every social situation you get into feels, you know, completely overwhelming to your nervous system? And that's where we start to look at those strategies in the past, where there's a reason why that developed. And so rather than just looking at it as this frustrating, you know, disappointing symptom, right, that it's something that we show up with that oftentimes makes us frustrated and gets in the way of what we want for ourselves, that we look back and we see that, yeah, I mean, it's frustrating now. And there's also this benefit to it that it served. And so we sort of develop a more compassionate approach to those kinds of things. And then in so doing, work to resolve those. And so that's, I mean, when we look at like the different pieces of work that we do in an intensive, I think it's really speaks to that, where we connect with these younger parts of ourselves to see what we had to do to sustain in the world and how to, you know, give ourselves permission to have those conversations that we weren't allowed to have or didn't have space to have, or how to articulate and attend to the needs that we learned not to have because our environment wasn't able to meet them. And in so doing, we, you know, we detach from the outcome. Like, in a, you know, if we're facilitating a piece of work or I'm sitting in an NARM session, like, I don't have it's my responsibility to not have an agenda as to where I'm trying to get somebody to go, because there, you know, I guess I like to operate under this belief that if you can create a safe space and a container through which people can engage with openness, that they'll go in the direction that they need to, and they'll get out of the experience what they need to. And so, you know, that, as much as there's different elements to like an individual session that I would be running with, you know, through with NARM, that a lot of the principles and the way that sort of I see myself in showing up as a therapist relate pretty closely to how I show up in an intensive.
You know, Alex, I wasn't the one that hired you. Travis did that, because, you know, that's his purview. And the times that we worked together, I'm the one who spent most of the time talking. You know, I'm listening to you and I'm like, man, I haven't asked Alex about himself at all until we're doing this podcast. And I guess what I just want to share with you is how I can hear not just that you understand the concepts, but I can feel it in you, you know, and it makes sense why the intensives would be a good fit for you, because attachment-based therapy is synonymous essentially with, you know, kind of what you're describing, at least at this level. So I appreciate it. And I feel convicted that I need to ask more questions of my coworker when we're just hanging out. So thank you.
We didn't have much time to hang out that time.
We didn't. We were about our work. I want to ask you about clients that you work with and kind of who you're drawn to. If you're willing to, you can talk about clients that kind of challenge or trigger you more. So I guess the overall question is kind of talk about your clientele and those that you end up working with on a more regular basis.
I mean, golly, I think back, I guess I've been working in the therapeutic field since 2009. And so I've worked with many ranges of clients over that. I think probably the youngest client I've had is 5. And the eldest was somewhere in her late 60s, probably. So have a pretty wide range and, you know, different settings along those as well. I guess just to start off, it would be, I have so much gratitude and sort of respect for just the client who shows up, which, you know, sounds like kind of a cop out of an answer, but in some ways, like, no matter what is going on, no matter how sort of prickly they might be on the surface, no matter how many kind of confounding factors are showing up in, you know, them sitting down to my, you know, to therapy with me, that they're showing up and there's something, you know, there is some amount of hope in that, right? That, like, if people who don't have any hope that things can get better, don't go to therapy. I mean, you know, sometimes there's mandated situations and that kind of thing, right, but they still don't have to do it, right? Like, there is something sort of, you know, beautiful and unique about that, that I really respect. I think I really gravitate to the clients who want to do that deeper work. You know, sometimes, I see a lot of different folks here at the counseling center, and a lot of times folks do come in for that quick fix of like, oh, I just need to teach you some skills of how to manage my anxiety. And, you know, we'll have a conversation with them. We're not going to like engage them in therapy that they don't want to do. But we'll often say that, you know, explain it the way I explained it to you a second ago, that, you know, there's something that's going on underneath that anxiety or that depression or whatever the face of the symptom is, that I sort of believe is going to be there no matter how many skills you practice. You know, skills can be great for certain situations, and, you know, sometimes band-aids are what you need if things are really, you know, really acute, or if you're in a, you know, real crisis. But at the end of the day, if there's work to be done when it comes to addressing the underlying issues, that's what I really show up for and really love. And that's honestly the experience that I've had with the intensives, is that it's a self-selecting group, right? Nobody, you know, not your average person does not walk in and say, yeah, I'm just thrilled about the idea of doing 4.5 days of group therapy. And even some participants don't, you know, aren't totally thrilled about that. And that makes a lot of sense too. And, you know, at the same time, they also recognize that there's benefit to it and there's opportunity in doing that work. And I think that is some of the most profound work that I've done or, you know, I've been a part of, or just, you know, even burn witness to. So at this point, you know, as far as more specific skill, I work mostly with adults and tend to find that the you know, the ones who are engaged in that deeper work and interested in it are can just make a lot of headway quickly. I think I also, there's a particular part of me that really likes working with men, you know, because I think I can relate to the experience. I grew up playing rugby and football and, you know, having various influences of what we might call our toxic masculinity in our society, right? But I also had a dad who was, you know, pretty open with expressing his feelings and talking about things. And so I can sort of see both sides of it and can relate to the way in which a man growing up in our society can have a pretty limited experience. There's not, you know, there's, we're not necessarily allowed to, you know, objectively not allowed to have the depth of relationships, you know, the, what we're allowed to do with ourselves, what we're allowed to present, what we're allowed to express emotionally is pretty narrow. And so some of the most, I think, meaningful work that I've done has been working with, you know, young men here at the university to give themselves permission to show up as themselves and to be authentic and to admit that things were sad or hard or scary, and that, you know, that's a human experience. It doesn't make them any less. And so that feels like something of a calling to me that I really show up for.
You know, you're articulating so well something that I talk about. I mean, we run an experiential program in the wilderness with adolescents and young adults. Obviously our intensives program is largely experiential because of the psychodrama. But one of the things I often say is the experience of just showing up, even in talk therapy in an office, is itself experiential, because you are taking the risk to show up. And the risk is that the therapist is going to treat you the same way that others have in the past, which is trying to fix you and telling you what's wrong with you and not looking at the symptom like you're describing as really a solution to a deeper, more profound, more fundamental. So I love how you talk about that idea of showing up. It's a simple phrase. I'm not sure if all listeners will hear how profoundly deep the idea of to show up in a session, even when you're kind of coerced, is still a heroic act, which I think is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I think I notice, especially for my work at the university with oftentimes young adults. And I mean, I certainly didn't have the bandwidth or self-awareness to show up to therapy right when I was 18. And especially, you know, on my own as a personal choice to better myself. And that's something that's, you know, especially if these folks have grown up in, you know, small towns around Utah or just had different, you know, just growing up in families where they weren't allowed to be themselves. Like, it is an incredible honor to be a part of, you know, that conversation of like, now we're out of that space. Like, what do you want for yourself in the world? What do you, you know, go ahead and dye your hair, go ahead and, you know, date who you want, you know, like that's that experience of supporting individuation is pretty powerful.
I love it. How does an understanding of and attentiveness to complex trauma issues relate to your work at intensives?
At this point in my career, it's just the lens that I interpret every conversation that I have in therapy about. You know, but specifically, we you know, with one of the activities is where we invite participants to draw a wound. And that isn't, you know, the intent of that is not to dredge up painful memories or, you know, get people to cry. But, you know, the way that I frame it is to recognize that, you know, I guess there's a couple of pieces in my mind that we all have this experience of trauma, whether we call it that or not. I think I'm more inclined to because of my background, but, you know, we all have wounds in our past, right? And we all learned how to survive and sustain amidst those, because we're all here, we're all showing up to this space. And so what can be powerful is not just identifying that piece for yourself and saying like, oh, this is something that, you know, that I had to move through that influenced how, you know, how I show up in my relationships with, you know, other people in my life and myself now. And I think there's something, you know, so much of our trauma in those situations is related to other people. And that's something that I think is powerful as we draw, you know, as we draw and share our wounds, is not just saying it for the sake of it, but also finding the ways in which we relate that, you know, oftentimes these things are incredibly isolating and incredibly shameful, right? So much of this, we put so much on our shelf because that's usually what we hear, the messages we received. And so there's healing in that space of just holding, holding attention, holding awareness of the fact that we all experience these hard things, and that, you know, we can still be complete, and that we can still be humans, and that we can still have hope in our lives and be successful. And so that, I think, is a reflection of how I see the work in intensives happening. And I think why there's programmatically, we start by going back, mm-hmm. right? We start with our wounds and we look to family of origin, and then to get a better understanding of what the dynamics are that led us to where we're at now, like led us to that shared space in, you know, in Heber, Utah. And then we do bring it back to the present day. And that's where I think, you know, I think there is an element of certain NARM therapies, or excuse me, certain trauma therapies, focus really heavily on just the past, right? Just kind of desensitizing to, you know, all of these stories and that kind of thing. And there's a lot of people who have benefited from that. And from my perspective and sort of what we believe with NARM is that, you know, the problem is not that, you know, so-and-so, you know, a horrible event happened 15 years ago. I mean, that is an influence, but more it's how that shows up for us now, what we had to do to adapt to that problem 15 years ago that is getting in the way of our lives today. And that's why I think that makes so much sense to connect those pieces to see, like, oh, in this situation where I'm having this, you know, argument with my partner, that it's really not me that's showing up and says all these intense and hurtful things. It's the part of me that was, you know, was wounded as a little kid. You know, the part of me that had to fight for validation or attention or support. And in that way, my observation is that people are able to, as they respond and attend to that kind of wounded and, you know, or traumatized part of themselves, that they can show up differently, that there's, you know, we're able to embody that adult consciousness, and meet some of the needs that weren't met when they were young by other people, through, you know, through the shared space of the intensive, but also through ourselves, like tell ourselves and attend to the needs that we had, so that we can show up in this conversation with our partner and not feel like that, you know, triggered 11-year-old, but show up as the, you know, independent, autonomous adult that we want, and the one who has agency to guide the encounters and experiences in our lives.
You know, I always know whenever somebody's a compelling speaker or teacher, the way that I can recognize it is I want to talk. And I keep wanting to talk. I'm supposed to be interviewing you, but I keep wanting to kind of share back and forth. But I do want to share one thing. So you've inspired me to share something.
Yeah,
just tell it to you that way. Last week I wrote this. I said, instead of thinking of your symptom as the problem, you can think of it as the solution. Then you can ask yourself, what mm-hmm. problem is the symptom solving? And that reminds me, yeah. I mean, that's like the same page. So thank you for the inspiration.
I mean, that kind of encapsulates my view on therapy and the world at this point.
It only took me literally 25 years of practice to come up with it in one phrase. So you're long ahead of me. So before I ask my last question, I always like to ask our guests, is there some place if people want to learn more about you that they can get a hold of you?
Sure. So I have it easily accessible by email. It's alexwhite.cmhc, so clinical mental health counselor @gmail.com. And have an Instagram that chronicles some of the different work that I do and that kind of thing, which is alexwhite, again, one word, .adventuretx. So adventure, treatment or therapy. AlexWhite.AdventureTX is the Instagram. So feel free to reach out at either of those. I'm happy to talk more about these and answer any questions that might arise.
Well, before we wrap up, Alex, I like to ask my last question with my guests, which is, can you say something about your self-care? You know, what do you do for self-care? You know, where, how you struggle with it? What do you, what's your practice? What do you try to do to make sure that you can have this capacity that you're describing today to show up for your clients, for others, in the way that, that they need your support?
That is a bit of a continual continual journey for me, I would say. Part of my strategy or my experience growing up was to not put strain on others around me by needing things. And so did what I could to sort of self-soothe and attend to myself as I could. And, you know, now to this day, as I put more words to these old strategies, I can recognize where I find myself, you know, taking on a lot or working way too late or, you know, struggling to shut the computer down and instead of, you know, responding to emails or writing notes or that kind of thing. And so part of my work has just been recognizing that I need self-care along with everybody else. And, you know, as much as I say that too, I think I'm fortunate in that I've spent most of my adult life living in mountain towns and really gravitate to the outdoors. So I had a client once that I was working with outside who put it really well that, you know, whether the, you know, it's raining or it's cold or it's hot or it's warm or it's beautiful, that, you know, the natural world doesn't have any judgments about us. And, you know, for me, I think before I really had words for it was was a space in which I could show up for myself or show up as myself. And so, you know, I love going on hikes with my dog and rock climbing, all of the fun things that Utah has to offer. But I'm also a big, I mean, it's in some ways it makes sense that I really love group therapy because I'm also somebody who really loves, you know, being a part of a group, a community, a sense of belonging. I've always been a part of sports teams growing up and, you know, different professional communities and that kind of thing. And so, you know, I'm a big live music person. I love that kind of collective effervescence experience where we're all kind of showing up for this greater purpose that's beyond any of us. And, you know, even just getting together with friends and making dinner or hanging out is something that I think I'm learning more and more is a important part of my life and my capacity that I really need to prioritize, particularly given how the last year and a half have gone, that, you know, I know no experience where I'm, you know, even just sitting around doing nothing with a friend is taken advantage of or taken for granted anymore.
Favorite concert ever?
That's tough. I will say that probably one of my favorite concert experiences is up at a ski resort called Grand Targhee up in Wyoming. And they have a small bluegrass festival and a small sort of eclectic music festival that would be, when I was living in Jackson Hole, were staples of our, we would build our summer program schedule around these festivals to say like, okay, we don't have to, we're not scheduling program this week so we can be there all 3 days, because it was just this experience where it's, you know, outrageously beautiful, great music. And, you know, because it was such a small festival near a small town, it was kind of just going with all your friends.
That combines all three: outdoors, community and friends, and live music. So that makes sense.
There you go. I mean, if I could just, put all those pieces together, that pretty much does it for me.
Well, thank you, Alex. I really appreciate having you and embarrassingly getting to know you better in this context, in this capacity. So I really appreciate you coming on and being a guest and sharing your wisdom with our audience.
Great to be here. Great to be a part of this team. I was just reflecting today on how much I appreciate that. And I'm excited for not only what's to come, but not only what's happened, but what's to come. And, you know, hopefully we will have that opportunity here soon to collaborate again.